Welcome to the February 2021 edition of RehabCast, the official podcast brought to you by the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and hosted by yours truly, Dr. Ford Vox of the Shepherd Center in Atlanta. In this episode, we're going to be visiting with Sam Kalachis of the Ohio-based technology innovation company Battelle. Sam is winner of the 2020 Launchpad competition at the ACRM Annual Conference. We will hear about Sam's winning submission and some of his other work in the neurotech field. Also in this edition of the RehabCast, we're talking with Lance Trexler about his special communication in the journal, published in the November 2020 issue. It looks closely at the use of opioids post-TBI. The position paper makes a number of practical recommendations for the judicious use of this highly risky class of medications in the vulnerable TBI population. Let's get started. Okay, and joining us now on the RehabCast is Sam Kalachis. Sam has the winning submission for the 2020 ACRM Conference's Launchpad competition, namely an interactive activities of daily living assistance device. Sam is a research scientist at Battelle. If you've listened to this podcast in the past, I think you have heard about Battelle before with some of its other neuro rehabilitation related research. It's an Ohio-based technology company with a lot of tendrils in different areas of medicine and industry, and we'll certainly hear a bit more about that in this interview as well. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, doing very well. As we were just chatting, I've got to share with the audience this fascinating history that your family has with the field of physical medicine and rehabilitation. So your grandfather, Sam Kalachis, was a president of ACRM back in the 1980s and was a rehabilitation physician. And your father is a physiatrist as well and in charge of the spinal cord injury program over at OSU. And here you've stayed related in the field as well, doing neuroengineering. Quite a family dynasty in rehabilitation. That is really cool to see.
Yeah, it's definitely a small world. I mean, like I mentioned to you before, you know, I just recently found out that my grandfather was the president. But again, you know, I grew up in a family of spinal cord injury physicians and living that rehab. You know, rehab was the conversation at the dinner table. My mom was also a rehabilitation nurse, worked with, with spinal cord injury patients, stroke patients, individuals with traumatic brain injuries. So I kind of grew up, you know, again, talking about that with them often and thought about being a physician myself, but found that I really loved the engineering side of it and decided that, you know, my path made more sense to develop technologies that could help these individuals.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating field in terms of its potential interface with biotechnology and neuroengineering. I mean, with the, you know, physical accoutrements, as it were, of robotics and everything and computers and so forth. And so a huge opportunity for that. And the fact that you're so enmeshed, you have family-wise and everything from childhood and the medicine side of it seems like a perfect combination to me. Probably has something to do with looking like you're having a successful career in it thus far.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, it definitely helps to at least have the background with the clinical side of things, because you get so deep into the engineering sometimes that you often forget about the end user, mm-hmm. right? And you really need to build in those user needs into anything that you're developing. So, you know, it helps to have those connections with people I've met over the years that know my father. And you know, we've actually, I'll get into it a little bit more, but for this specific project, you know, he put me in contact with one of the TBI director over at Dodd. And she's been working closely with me, Dr. Bavishi, and she's helping to recruit patients, or eventually will, to help actually test the system.
Very cool. That's great to hear. Yeah, my one complaint about the technology side of things that I see with various startups and so forth is sometimes folks let the fact that you can do something or the technical ability to invent X, Y, or Z then search out the potential need for it. So you develop the widget first, and then you kind of find where that widget is going to plug in or create the customer base for that. But I find it somewhat frustrating when it comes to practical problems in my own field of medicine. More of it should be derived from kind of looking at the actual consumer first and then what widget they need.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Going after those unmet needs. Yep.
Preaching to the choir there, it sounds like.
Yeah. I'm still guilty of it myself because, you know, I do innovate and I want to push, but, you know, the products that are always the most successful are those that are pulled from the market, right? Or by the market.
So, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, one of the coolest devices that I've seen in recent years was derived from an engineer looking at a friend who had quadriplegia, wanted to be able to control different devices, and came up with a simple Bluetooth device that can be controlled by the mouth. And we've actually ended up using that a lot here at Shepherd Center with interfacing with different computers and so forth. So, starting with the patient, the individual seems to be very important. Now, with regards to this little competition that ACRM has had going now for a few years, the idea is to get the diverse membership of ACRM, which includes everyone from engineers to all different types of clinicians and people working together to kind of compete and come up with different ideas for practical tools, recognizing that the rehabilitation space has a lot of potential for different types of industry device collaboration and so forth. And I think it's generated a lot of interest at the conference in recent years. And it looks like year after year is getting a little bit more competitive, which is good to see, and some fancier projects being submitted. And I would certainly wager that your project is one of those. So in the TBI space, you've particularly gone after occupational therapy and the fact that, certainly like all forms of therapy, we would like to be able to deliver it potentially more than we can with a one-on-one. Certainly looking at the pandemic right now, there's an opportunity there to do potentially less of the in-person therapy. Now, so you're looking at what can be done with the utilization of different forms of technology, which you're going to describe to us, in order to recognize what a patient is doing on a tabletop task, something as simple as perhaps meal preparation, laying out the utensils and plate and cup and everything, and putting things in correct order and so forth. But you would need then a system that could in real time look at what the patient is doing and judge how that is against the paradigm of how we would like for them to do it. I assume both motor-wise and technically correct about what it looks like on the table. That's a fascinating idea. Now, translating that into an actual practical system really seems like a tall order. What of the technologies, and first, feel free to revise as I'm attempting to describe what the system is. Summarize us for it a little bit, and then start to elaborate for us what are some of the main technological barriers or what is really the toughest part of creating this system?
Yeah, no, I mean, you summarized it very nicely. So I do want to start off by saying, and again, you mentioned it, our goal is not to replace an occupational therapist, and it never will be. And that's obviously foolish, right? I mean, the interactions between a therapist and a patient, there's so many intricacies, and the goal here is not to replace that, right? I mean, it will never be that good, right? The computers will never, I mean, maybe 50 years from now, right? Everyone's job will be replaced, but that's not the plan. It's the idea really is, like you said, you know, patients only get a certain amount of time with their, you know, a physical therapist, occupational therapist, whatever, due to insurance reimbursement issue or limitations, finances, even just like your location where you live, your access to care, right? So there's a lot, even when you're inpatient, you're getting a lot of, I mean, depending on where you're at, you're getting a lot of rehab, but you could always be getting more and more practice. And I actually shadowed a few sessions with occupational therapists and patients early on before we started developing the technology. And it seemed like almost everyone, all the patients, their family members are asking, what can we do when we go home? Right. What can we keep doing? And, you know, it is challenging with individuals with cognitive impairment. The system requires setup, right? And, you know, it's never going to, again, it's not going to be a standalone. They set it up themselves. It's going to eventually be maybe a caregiver sort of helps them, but it provides guidance, that little extra bit. And also, so I'll explain a little bit what the technology is, but again, I just wanted to clarify or to reinforce that. Yeah. Right. It's just extra practice what we're going for. And really, like you said, it's what we started off with, some tabletop evaluation. So things like meal preparation, medication management, money management tasks. So, you know, there might be tasks that you can vary in difficulty. So count out this much money, right? Things that are those activities or those instrumental activities of daily living. Again, you know, prompting the participant to go through steps and activity. And then we have a camera-based system that visualizes all of their interactions. And we use state-of-the-art object recognition or object detection algorithms to identify where in space those objects are, how they're being manipulated, and how the user is interacting with them. So if I simply ask someone to, you know, place out a certain amount of money or in the medication management task to place pills in a certain in a certain bin, right? The system, using the object recognition, can detect if they've done things correctly or incorrectly and prompt them as a therapist would to say, hey, you've tried doing it this way, and we can vary the amount of involvement, but, you know, try doing it this way, or it should be this way, or, you know, that's great, and give them that positive or negative reinforcement.
So object recognition, is this the mastermind that we're all training with those CAPTCHAs online and those types of things? Is this an algorithm that is AI? I mean, what is this?
Right, exactly. It's the machine learning algorithms. It's the same kind of stuff they're using with the automated vehicles, right? So it's the state-of-the-art object detection algorithms, right? So we're leveraging those same ones here, or similar ones, and really just applying it in a new space, right? I mean, this, we haven't really seen, at least in the rehab world, this being done, obviously, right, with automated vehicles, and even in manufacturing and factories and automating there, they do a lot of object detection. So, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done there. So it's kind of leveraging that technology in a new application. And again, getting into a whole new space where we can use that to really understand an individual's performance with these sort of complex activities, right? And the other piece to it as well is, you know, there might be something for prompting someone that they're doing it correctly or incorrectly, but another thing that we found as we were developing this and talking with different therapists and clinicians is that there really isn't a great tool that exists right now to quantify somebody's abilities. Really, it's more based on the clinician's judgment. So they ask you to perform make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and maybe you try that. Maybe they start off with cards and the ordering. I've seen that where they order pictures and that, but then they actually go to do a real task. And they're able to sort of walk them through, okay, this is what you need to work on and so on, right? But they're not sitting there quantifying all of the, you know, what's your reaction time? How long did it take you to do this? How many mistakes did you make? I mean, they're kind of counting in the back of their head, but that's not their main focus. Their main focus is the being involved and helping with that rehab process. And that's something we actually learned along the way, and where we're starting to kind of shift gears a bit, where we think there might be a bigger unmet need actually the ability to quantify their performance while they're working with the therapist, and then be able to get like spit out a chart of, you know, here's how you did in these categories, right? You're really good at sequencing tasks, but you're not so good at these types of tasks. You know what?
Right? Or this could be kind of the more standardized measure that you might do once a week or a couple of times a week to document the fact that overall it's improving.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And it would be objective, right? I mean, when you work with individuals, you have by design a subjective quantification. So one person might do an assessment versus another, and then you potentially could fit a patient within different categories because of it. Right. So using the computer to objectively assess alongside a therapist where they are in one embodiment, right? Where they're still helping with the rehab aspect. But then the other element too is, you know, you could take this home and it could help also guide your caregiver or family member who doesn't really know how to be a therapist, but help them be a little bit more hands-on as well. So these are a couple different embodiments we envision.
Really fascinating. And certainly it does require, it looks like, enough setup and everything at this time that further revision within that inpatient environment before actually graduating to the outpatient world certainly makes sense. Although, I mean, I guess nobody's stopping you from going and proving proof of concept. Go ahead and try it outpatient in the home as well. It's something that in-home-based therapists could work with as well and set people up to then, you know, do this multiple times while I'm away, and I'll come back and check in on you and things like that.
Exactly.
So many different possibilities, and also all, you know, not just occupational therapy, but could, you know, there's speech therapy applications, physical therapy applications. We do see in the physical therapy world has been a bit more aggressive with different types of home exercise type programs online and everything, and therapists being able to record videos for their patients to be able to then do, you know, repeat these exercises later and things like that. Certainly occupational therapy with regards to something as complicated as some type of tabletop task set up and food and everything, I've not heard about that being done anywhere else. That's entirely novel. And then a lot of these same tools could then be entered into those other therapy spaces as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like you alluded to, I mean, there's a lot of work that's kind of shifting towards that sort of remote health, right? And it's patients, especially like you mentioned early on with the pandemic right now. I mean, it's critical to be having conversations remotely with your clinician or a therapist or so on, and being able to have those tools that help the therapist with the things that are, you know, a little bit more computationally intensive for them, to allow them to focus more on the stuff that a computer can't do and their human input, right? Those are sort of what we're heading towards, right? And you made the exact point about physical therapy. There's a lot of tools out there, and they're still progressing, right? But, you know, I've seen other kind of products where they're tracking someone's pose and position and stuff, and they're using a lot of, you know, the machine learning and artificial intelligence to do so. But like you said, there's the occupational therapy side of it hasn't really been tapped into. So this sort of, at least I've been visioning it as the other half to that story, right? And just completing that full therapy, right? So,
yeah. And you included in your presentation kind of what competition exists in this space as well. And it's important to elaborate for our audience a little bit. I mean, like looking at this Visual Impact 3 and HoloLens, the pieces of the puzzle that are missing there. So, I mean, certainly you can just, you know, visually show people and then, you know, have them do a task. And that's what the Visual Impact kind of ADL task is doing. It gives you step-by-step instructions to do something, but it doesn't have this machine learning of being able to actually assess what you're doing and then judge that. And that's really the whole critical piece there. And then the HoloLens virtual assistant, I gather, you're not actually physically doing something. Although I guess it does have some, would you describe that for us? I understand it's described in a 2018 paper. Like, what is the HoloLens?
Right. So they're using virtual reality. So it's interacting with objects in a virtual world, which is, it's great work they've done, but it's the difference here is that patients are actually able to interact with the real world objects, get that tactile input, just boost their training with the actual thing that it is that they're going to do, right? Whether it's making a sandwich, doing medication, or even brushing your teeth, right? That's something else we've been thinking about. We've kind of been focusing first on the tabletop exercises because it's a little bit simpler from a design standpoint, but certainly envision getting to a point where maybe even the patient wears, you know, glasses, as smart glasses are, and that's kind of where we started actually. And we decided we want to start a little bit simpler and grow to that. But as smart glasses technology is, you know, getting like Apple starting to invest in this, so on, right? We certainly see a future where you could use that technology to see from the individual's perspective how they're doing. And then this almost could be an assistive device as well, right? So they're going around their house. They need all those step-by-step things like putting something in a microwave, right? And having the assistance. And then they get the practice doing it as well. So that is a future that we envision as well.
One I can imagine smart glasses like that, being able to load into smart glasses what a particular patient's deficits or impairments are. They tend to ignore as basic as the left side or something like that. And so these glasses need to help them look out for that left side and give them a little more feedback and those types of things. That could really be a fascinating line of work there. So, there's so much technology out there that already exists that needs to be translated in a practical way to practical problems that we face in neurorehabilitation. That work seems very fruitful. And well, tell us a little bit about some of the other lines of work related to neuro rehab that you're involved in at Battelle.
Right. Yeah, certainly. So, yeah, as I mentioned, you know, we have a whole neuro program at Battelle, and we're sort of based within our med device group. So Battelle does all kinds of work, right? We do a lot of government contracts, military work, you know, just health, general health work. We had a lot of involvement with the pandemic recently with the coronavirus, but at least where I sit is in the neuro group, which is sort of, like I said, a subsection of the medical devices group. And we are exploring all kinds of technology to help with all kinds of neurological impairments, right? So we sort of started off with, and we're still actively pursuing brain computer interfaces for spinal cord injuries. So a lot of our neuro work is kind of founded there, right? So working with spinal cord injury patients, implanting microelectrode arrays in the motor cortex and using that to drive electrical stimulation in the forearm. So we've developed a full forearm, high definition functional electrical sleeve that we can stimulate like very fine dexterity and get complex movements and essentially reanimate the motor abilities of individuals who have you know, physical limitations. And we've recently been trying to take that kind of fundamental technology and bring it into the stroke world, right? So for stroke rehabilitation. So there's a lot of work with functional electrical stimulation in rehabilitating individuals who have suffered a stroke. But there doesn't really exist this kind of technology with a high definition array, a sleeve where you can really target in on specific muscles non-invasively, right? Non-invasively. And be able to get very fine motor control and reanimate limbs in a very dexterous way. And the other pieces that we've been exploring too is trying to understand an individual's physiology. So recording from the muscle activity with that same sort of technology, the high definition array, and recording muscle activity and using that to sort of quantify someone's impairment, right? So we've got a lot of work going on there. Again, heavily focused in the stroke world on that. And then we have a couple other similar technologies that kind of leverage the machine learning and artificial intelligence aspects that we bring to each of those projects. And we have work in with the cardiovascular system and using vagus nerve stimulation in sort of a closed loop manner to affect an individual's heart rhythm and state, right? And detect when there's an imbalance and correct for it. We're doing work with DARPA where we have a minimally invasive brain computer interface where we have using magnetoelectric nanoparticles to both stimulate and record. So, you know, a little bit of everything, right? And But
that's pretty exciting. Yeah, quite an array of things to get involved in. It must be challenging for someone like you to decide which of these projects you can't do them all. What all you're going to do on a given day? That's something else. Very cool. Well, like I mentioned at the beginning, this project was the winner of the Launchpad in 2020. We certainly look forward to seeing how it comes to fruition over coming time. You're already starting to work with it more so in the inpatient TBI program there at OSU. Can you give us a little bit of insight into perhaps what you have planned, kind of what you're thinking about direction-wise over the course of the next year or two?
Right. So, you know, right now we're still very much in the engineering development phase where we have the sort of proof of concept enough to demonstrate the technology. And now it's a matter of taking it to the clinic, right? And we have over the summer planned to do to test with probably around 10 participants, a couple hour sessions here and there where they come in and just try out the system. Because we really need to understand, you know, what are the limitations of the on the engineering side, right? What are those little things that we haven't accounted for? How is an individual going to interact with the system? And so far we've tested with one participant and we learned a lot. That the participant had visual neglect and we found that we needed to prompt them that objects were off to their left when they couldn't see them. And there's all those kind of little design changes that need to be implemented. So right now we're very much in that kind of feasibility phase, proof of concept, trying to get tweak the engineering aspects, and at the same time be thinking about the usability and how the system will end up being used, or how the end user will use this system. And all at the same time, you know, like I mentioned, because we have all of these sort of different projects, sometimes you get a little bit of pull from one project, and you kind of have within projects sort of competition with time and resources. And as I mentioned, you know, we have a big thrust moving towards the stroke rehabilitation space. So I do think we'll probably apply this technology there, because like you mentioned, you know, right, with the sleeve technology, we're very much focused on the motor rehabilitation aspects, but we're not so much focused on the cognitive side, which often comes along with many strokes, right? So I think we'll probably eventually introduce it into that world, and it may change our design a little bit of the system, but hopefully for the better, right? Like I said, we're really focused right now on trying to get that market feedback and understand those unmet needs and reach out to as many clinicians as we can to really understand what their needs are, so we can build our technology around that and not just be pushing tech. So
fantastic. Well, I hope this podcast helps then in terms of that reach out. Everyone can reach out to Sam at Battelle, and you can find his information on the ACRM website under Launchpad as the winner of that competition. And you may get a few new collaborators interested out of this, Sam. I hope so.
Yeah, thank you. Hopefully.
Well, thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Moving on now, next up is a highlight from the November 2020 issue of the Archives. Okay, and joining us now on the Rehab Cast is Dr. Lance Trexler. Lance is Executive Director of Brain Injury Rehabilitation Research and Program Development at the Rehabilitation Hospital of Indiana. He also teaches in the Department of PM&R at Indiana University School of Medicine, as well as Speech and Hearing Sciences at Indiana University, and he is in the Psychological Sciences Department at Purdue. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Trexler.
Thank you for inviting me, Dr. Vox.
Well, so the paper today is what's called a special communication in the archives of PM&R. These special communications are generally invited commentaries from experts such as yourself and your colleagues. And in this case, it's one that is certainly on a topic certainly big in the national news in terms of the opioid crisis, and has huge implications actually, and perhaps unseen, understood to some extent, the degree to which it involves the traumatic brain injury community. Certainly, this is a struggle that clinicians deal with regularly, dosing appropriate pain medications in these populations. It's also one in which your communication paper lays out that perhaps the rest of the medical world, in particular substance use disorder programs, need to be more aware of, too. Now, before I say too much more about why you might have written the paper, perhaps you can tell me why you and your colleagues, which include Dr. John Corrigan, Dr. Shashank Davi, and Flora Hammond, Dr. Hammond, joined together to write this paper.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Vox. I think what really fostered a decision to try and get something out quickly is when we were working on a paper, a study that found that if you had a traumatic brain injury, you were about 11 times more likely to die of an opioid overdose. And I think that many, many prescribers don't know that they're prescribing to someone with a TBI, and may have the kind of cognitive and neurobehavioral characteristics that they do, and how that might affect their compliance or not with the medications.
Was this a TBI model system study that you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay. And that's an important type of surveillance information that can pick out a number of trends of which folks might otherwise not be aware of or be aware of generally, but not understand the magnitude of the link there. I mean, 11 times more risk, that's pretty extraordinary.
That's what we thought, and we were looking at a variety of medications, and and just also the number of people in inpatient rehabilitation for traumatic brain injury, you know, about 65% of people with traumatic brain injury in inpatient rehabilitation are going to be on at least one opioid.
And as you point out, there's a lot of just somewhat thoughtless carryover, whatever the inpatient medication regimen or treatment regimen was for a patient, perhaps months or years following, unfortunately, this patient population.
Absolutely. And so what we've got then is a mental, you know, we've got a pain clinic or a physician prescribing or sustaining that opioid prescription, not knowing the risk factors associated with the traumatic brain, their history of traumatic brain, especially the mental health, you know, and the substance abuse providers may not be aware of that history and the implications for their prescriptions.
And of course, folks in the TBI community, I think, generally understand that sometimes TBI is almost part of a disease process in and of itself. I mean, we classically think of stroke that way. I mean, certain risk factors that are associated with it, whether high blood pressure and cholesterol and so forth. Well, there are certainly risk factors that could potentially lead to some forms of traumatic brain injury. And as you point out, one of those could be substance abuse.
Absolutely. I think the work of Dr. Corrigan and his teams and colleagues have demonstrated that substance abuse is a risk factor for TBI. But then there's also a bidirectional kind of relationship, because childhood TBI is a risk factor for, and adolescent TBI is a risk factor for substance abuse. So I think in when we get someone in for an index TBI or their most recent TBI, we often forget to look at that as a potentially neurodevelopmental sort of problem, starting with earlier TBI, leading to substance abuse, leading to another TBI.
Now, as you point out, there are really kind of two chief locations of care when it comes to these moderate and severe traumatic brain injuries. There's the early acute trauma and rehabilitation phase, your inpatient phase, and then your whole outpatient world and that struggle as well. And that's where lots of other medical providers start to get potentially involved as well, various pain doctors and certainly substance use disorder clinics and so forth as well. Patients may not be carrying forward their history of a prior traumatic brain injury in the first place, or those providers may not fully understand the implications of it. Let's talk, though, about that inpatient phase, over which I imagine a number of the folks listening to this podcast are involved in as well, and where we perhaps have the most control and ability to perhaps set things on the right foot going forward for what can, in some of these cases, certainly be a chronic condition. You point out that there is a high prevalence of opioid prescription in the first place. At the same time, perhaps our treatment desires for this patient population conflicts to some extent with what we're being asked to do with hospital culture and treating pain as a vital sign and so forth. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, and we made some recommendations for this phase in our paper and archives. You know, I think the first issue is starting with as a small a dose as possible and a shortest possible dose prescription, because, you know, you can even 7 to 10 days can be risky on an opioid in terms of promoting dependence. So I think what we recommend in this acute phase or in the post-acute phase in the inpatient rehabilitation is try and get a multidisciplinary plan in place to manage pain as quickly as possible. And get your physical therapist and occupational therapist, psychologist addressing this in context of a plan to discontinue the opioid, if possible, by the time they leave the hospital. So that would be starting with admission. Is this patient on an opioid? And first team conference, what are we going to do to get them off? And what's our plan as a team to do so? Including family education, inpatient education on the risks associated with them, and get their buy-in.
Yeah, so really elevating that on the list of problems that folks are addressing on a weekly basis in those team conferences as well, and really thinking about what everyone can do to potentially contribute to get this dose lower and this usage lower.
Absolutely.
And you point out the importance of obviously diagnosing the source of pain as well, whether it's truly, you know, nociceptive, you know, or orthopedic in nature, or
right,
neuropathic, and really exploiting the full range of medications that are available that are non-opioid to treat pain.
Right. Yeah. You know, as you well know, you know, opioids aren't the treatment of choice for neuropathic pain. And so let's not start them on when it's not the first indication.
I'm certainly a big fan of broader neuropathic pain medication treatment, as hopefully a lot of my inpatient neurorehabilitation colleagues are. Over time, I've certainly reduced my usage of opioid pain medications and feel like I've noticed a significant improvement in my patients' cognition and overall alertness as I've done that as well. And I would highly encourage others to experience that firsthand for themselves if they've not done so yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's clear that these medications can sustain delirium, post-traumatic delirium or confusion, and can sustain cognitive impairment in the chronic phase.
And as you point out, there is a lack of understanding, unfortunately, to some extent in the broader medical community with kind of this silent epidemic of brain injury, and to the extent to which people can be cognitively and behaviorally involved without necessarily looking like they're bouncing off the walls, but still be highly sensitive to maladaptive behaviors when it comes to substance use because of the nature of the brain injury. As a neuropsychologist, speak to us about that.
Well, I think, you know, we don't think about the accommodating the effects of the traumatic brain injury when we're writing a prescription. So a person may have knowledge of the fact that they shouldn't overuse their medication, but we know that in TBI there can be a dissociation between what you know and what you do, and so that's one issue where people with a TBI obviously forget, and sometimes they forget they've taken their medication and they take it again, and so we need accommodations in place and family education. And we really recommend that families be part of that management of the opioid and the discontinuance plan and help with accommodations because of the effects of the TBI.
You know, going back to that inpatient care phase, perhaps outpatient a bit too, there's always a search for meaningful quality metrics in rehabilitation care. And it's always disappointing when you see, you know, Medicare picks something like, well, how much of your staff is immunized by the flu or something, although
right,
perhaps that's getting more important with COVID and so forth. But
right,
it occurs to me, would, you know, kind of the overall MME usage on a rehabilitation unit be potentially a useful proxy of the measure to which that rehab team and facility are putting resources to this problem of pain management versus putting a Band-Aid on?
I think that's a great idea. And I think that, you know, as we look forward here, we really have to have, I want to kind of reemphasize, starting off with even before admission, an awareness that this patient's on an opioid and sometimes multiple. And in fact, in a recent pull of data, a large data set, we found that of people with traumatic brain injury, 20% of them were prescribed opioids and benzodiazepines. And so now we've got even another layer of the problem on top of this. And I think it's important to, when that patient hits the door of the inpatient rehabilitation facility, start that plan, that discontinuance plan at that time.
And to carry that forward outpatient as well, most certainly. So in your paper, your team breaks apart kind of the acute and the chronic phase, and obviously some of these same principles: lowest dose possible, little as possible, use the correct medication if necessary, non-opioid if possible.
Right.
And then add in a few more things in that chronic phase, including more of an emphasis on that pain contract and urine drug screen testing and so forth. I think one of the one of the chief problems is that is perhaps as you're outlining here, the recognition that folks with that TBI history need more in the way of extra services going along with this, more in the way of the psychological support services. There needs to be more attention towards bringing that family in as well for that second viewpoint, and as the patient's own insight could certainly be limited.
Well, and I think, too, I think, of course, when the person has a traumatic brain injury, they're even now more vulnerable to potential sources of influence. So if you got family that's using, if you got family, friends that are using substances illegally, that person with TBI is going to be even now more vulnerable. And so I think being aware of who you're discharging this patient to, not only in context of their own history of substance abuse, but what's the family situation? What is the friend situation? And how does that increase risk for accidental poisoning or overdose from opioids?
At the same time, as it's important to be wary with prescription in this patient population too, we don't want to limit access to quality pain care. I know that there's been a huge conversation in the medical community about the CDC opioid guidelines perhaps being more aggressively interpreted than they should be for so-called quote-unquote legitimate pain patients who may have that ongoing need.
Right.
There's some sensitivity, and it's discussed in your paper, the extent to which a person with TBI might do some things that might seem to violate a pain contract or be somewhat disruptive in a group therapy session or so forth, that they need some degree of forgiveness for.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I clearly there are patients that need chronic opioid therapy. And so, if that's the case, then that's the case. But if that individual has a traumatic brain injury, we need some extra vigilance, and we need some family involvement. We need close monitoring, and we need to know what the risk factors are. I think just knowing how cognitively and neurobehaviorally impaired is really important in how you set up the plan to manage these drugs long term. And history of substance use disorder, and as I said, the environment in which they're being discharged.
Yeah. So definitely broadening that layer of thinking. So bottom line, it's incumbent upon the person who is managing chronically a person on opioids with a history of traumatic brain injury who may have some degree of neurological, ongoing cognitive, behavioral, psychological effect from that. You've got to track that in some form or fashion, just as much as you track that UDS.
Yeah. I think it'd be nice if in our discharge summaries, we gave our primary care docs a heads up. Let's insert something in there that says, by the way, you know, this, because of the traumatic brain injury, these are the risk factors for, and let's give them some education about that on a case-by-case basis.
Another practical suggestion you guys make is of course, upping that surveillance game in the first place. Looking at the huge industry of substance use disorder clinics and programs and so forth, really need to make sure that they're thoroughly screening for, and obviously then we hope have a different track for patients with a significant head injury history. But you mentioned in particular endorsing the Ohio State University identification method.
Right. Yeah, we feel like that's probably the most rigorous screening instrument with the best data. And what's really good about that instrument is that it time dates injuries, because as we've discussed, many of these people have multiple injuries, and getting a sense developmentally for the presence of lifetime exposure to TBI gives you a lot of information about the evolution of that opioid use disorder or potential for opioid use disorder and accidental overdose.
Fantastic. Obviously, one paper can't do the entire job. This has to be hopefully a reminder to the rehabilitation community of the importance of this, and everyone who is involved in rehabilitation has a part to play, even if you're not that ongoing chronic pain prescriber, in terms of helping educate the rest of the medical community, doing precisely what you say as far as that inpatient team, when everyone's hopefully on their A game, thinking about as many years in advance for this person as they can to put that plan in place so PCPs can see that going forward, future pain treaters can see that going forward. But certainly as we're doing our ongoing follow-ups and treatment of these patients, we too need to remain in communication with folks who are managing chronic pain in these patients. So there's a lot for us to do as kind of team players, kind of the rehab component for the rest of the medical system, understanding that folks with TBI are going to go on and be treated by a variety of medical providers over the over their lives coming forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I also want to mention, too, as part of our CDC funding on this project and through Indiana State Department of Health, we developed or we produced a series of webinars specific to this topic. And that they offer free CMEs as well with it.
Oh, great!
And if someone just does a Google search for opioids and TBI, an unrecognized relationship, they ought to be able to find this webinar. Dr. Hammond did the first one. That's what is a TBI. Dr. Corrigan did how to screen for TBI. I did the talk on increased risk for opioid misuse, and then Dr. Dave reviewed our prescribing recommendations, and Wendy Waldman, someone at RHI, did the talk on where to find brain injury resources and supports.
Well, Dr. Trexler, I really appreciate your time with us today going over this important special communication in the November archives of PM&R. Opioids and TBI, big national story, huge rehab component, a lot for us to do here as rehab providers. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Vox. Good to have this chat with you.
Yes, sir. And that does it for this February 2021 edition of RehabCast. This year's conference is September 26th through 29th. It will take place virtually, of course, but pandemic willing, and if safe to do so, we will have an in-person component in Dallas. If you enjoyed this episode, please click on your podcast share button and send it to some of your colleagues.